from artificial intelligence to artificial discovery, in an era defined by artificial intelligence's rapid ascent, one question keeps haunting me and the people I build with: what comes next? This essay ventures into uncertain territory, attempting to map the contours of an AI-transformed future through candid conversations, spirited debates, and panel discussions from lab automators events, discussions that reveal how laboratory automation is positioning itself as a catalyst for what we could call artificial discovery. I started writing this after our first lab automators event, where I heard stories from vendors, engineers, scientists, and executives in the Boston-Cambridge biotech RAND space. Most of my time since has been spent researching these conversations to see if they held water. While many examples draw from drug discovery, where these ideas were born, the implications extend far beyond any single field. By artificial discovery, I mean something specific. If AI makes intelligence cheap and abundant, then what becomes truly valuable is the act that has always constrained us: discovery. Throughout human history, despite billions of brilliant minds across countless generations, our species can be understood through a surprisingly small number of breakthrough findings. Intelligence was never the limiting factor. The real constraint has been discovery itself. I believe we're entering a phase beyond AI, the era of artificial discovery, where the bottleneck shifts from thinking to executing, testing, and iterating in the real world. It's AI-driven intelligence coupled with real-world feedback loops and rapid iteration, directed at producing new, validated insights rather than predictions or conclusions. If AI makes intelligence cheap and abundant, then what becomes truly valuable is the act that has always constrained us: discovery. Artificial discovery differs from terms like AGI or AI agents, which refer to code writing, code performing, code tasks. Billions of intelligent people have lived for countless generations, and while the discovery count is small, imagine the corpus of content they've generated since humanity's dawn. I love AI because we don't have to constantly spend our lives generating endless maybes in search of rare discoveries. Thinking is now cheap and fast, but testing those thoughts in reality remains slow. Modern AI systems generate hypotheses by the thousands, but physical verification takes months. Artificial discovery aims to automate and accelerate that verification loop. By integrating intelligent decision-making with automated experimentation, we can iterate on ideas almost as quickly in the physical world as in the digital realm. The new limiting factor becomes execution, and overcoming that constraint could unlock unprecedented innovation. What got us artificial intelligence? One way to grasp this emerging paradigm is to look at what we've seen in AI over the past decade. We can all certainly agree that an incredible amount has happened in just 3 years. Why so fast? What caused the step change that pushed us into a new, uncertain world where we must renegotiate our own value? I think the sudden, discontinuous improvement in large language models provides a blueprint for how scaling and feedback can bring about a new age, LLM evolution. Before the recent leap, NLP models were trained on relatively small, carefully labeled datasets. They were narrow in scope and brittle when faced with anything outside their training distribution. In 2017, Attention Is All You Need introduced the transformer. Attention removed the old sequential bottleneck by letting models consider all parts of an input in parallel, hugely improving learning efficiency and unlocking new scaling potential. Next, researchers turned to web-scale, unlabeled data. Instead of relying on curated datasets alone, we tapped massive corpora, web pages, Wikipedia, books, to pre-train LLMs. This is akin to screening trillions of molecules with little to no therapeutic. Purpose, breadth, and diversity outperformed hand curation. Data is different. Electrons move near the speed of light and don't take up much space. Around 2020, empirical scaling laws emerged. As model size, dataset size, and compute increased, performance improved along smooth power law curves that showed no sign of plateauing. These curves gave leaders the confidence to scale models 10x or 100x, predicting that gains would continue. Finally, reinforcement learning from human feedback, RLHF, closed the loop between raw model output and human preferences, aligning capability with what people actually wanted. You could argue that this is what truly kicked us into the AI world we inhabit now. Highly trained models refined with human input to unlock unseen capabilities. You could argue that this is what truly kicked us into the AI world we inhabit now. Highly trained models refined with human input to unlock unseen capabilities. Looking back, we see a few ingredients: a new method, abundant raw data, a visible scaling law, and a feedback loop, combining to yield a step change. Artificial discovery will need experimental equivalents of each. Biotech today: AI's prehistory in lab form. Maximize image. Edit image. Delete image. Today, many areas of biotechnology and other lab sciences still resemble that before picture of AI. We have huge sequence databases, analogous to the labeled corpora of early NLP, providing wealth of reference information. But knowing the genome sequence of a virus or protein amino acid sequence doesn't automatically reveal function or behavior. To discover those, we need physical experiments. Data alone won't generalize to insight without wet lab assays. Industry describes two paths forward. The first is computational, championed by Google DeepMind, Isomorphic Labs, Latent Labs, and others, which treats biology as fundamentally a computation problem. This perspective assumes we possess sufficient data about biophysical processes to uncover patterns beyond human reach. The key claim is that meaningful biological discovery requires simultaneously analyzing all available patterns, something only computational systems can achieve at scale. We've seen remarkable success in protein structure predictions that no human discovery has ever approached. Yet this computational approach faces limitations. Consider the current data landscape: protein structures, labeled sequence databases, amino acid annotations, and comprehensive data from approved drugs. This corpus functions like the carefully curated, labeled datasets that powered early NLP breakthroughs. The computational camp believes this existing labeled data contains enough signal to revolutionize biological understanding, that patterns await extraction by sufficiently powerful models. They're certainly right in scoped applications like protein structure prediction and genetic homology, but NLP also showed impressive results 10 years ago. Much of experimental science today looks like AI circa 2010 to 2015. Lots of data. Not always the right kind, tools awaiting a paradigm shift, and no clear map for scaling discovery. Some advocates acknowledge a data limitation, arguing we must collect vastly more experimental data to feed these computational engines. Here lies a critical economic reality: who will finance massive data collection without clear scaling laws to justify investment? Unlike AI, where predictable returns from increased compute and data have been observed, biology lacks established scaling relationships that guarantee proportional improvements in discovery capability. Without these assurances, the capital needed for comprehensive biological data generation remains speculative. Much of experimental science today looks like AI circa 2010 to 2015. Lots of data, not always the right kind, tools awaiting a paradigm shift, and no clear map for scaling discovery. There's been no equivalent transformer moment for most experimental methods. Perhaps accepting next-generation sequencing and its cost collapse. Tasks like phenotypic screening, chemical synthesis, or multi-omics profiling remain slow or expensive. Lab automation is largely static. Today's robots execute pre-programmed protocols without adapting to live data. Most automated labs today are programs without an if. They lack the ability to branch or change course mid-run. Crucially, we don't yet have a scaling law for physical experimentation. There's no Moore's law for wet lab throughput. We lack a clear quantitative curve, showing that 10x more experiments yields proportionally more discoveries. Brute force experimentation quickly runs into noise, variability, and logistical complexity. Without predictable scaling trends, investing heavily in raw experimental throughput looks like a gamble rather than a sure win. Closing these gaps is what will bring us into the artificial discovery age. Lessons from computing history. Maximize image. Edit image. Delete image. I take confidence from computing story. It shows how the right abstractions and feedback can unlock explosive capability. Computing history is really about how to scale problem solving once you find the right building blocks. Consider the universal building block of digital logic, the NAND gate. Given two inputs that can be true or false, the output is defined. You can physically embody on and off many ways: voltage high or low, liquid flowing or not, wavelength emitted or not. What's surprising is that the NAND gate is universal, with enough NAND gates, you can implement any logical operation or computer program. That composable primitive gave engineers a standard atom of computation from which to build arbitrarily complex circuits. Our first proof of concept was the ENIAC computer. It was massive, the size of an entire building floor. It didn't rely on NAND gate universality, but required bespoke electrical circuits. It needed a large staff to move electrical signals from gate to gate and rely on their advanced degrees to troubleshoot when logic chains broke. Sound familiar? A brief time capsule. Imagine standing in the ENIAC room in 1946. Rows of racks, patch panels, and vacuum tubes, air warmed by thousands of filaments. To change a program, you move cables and set switches. Just try to imagine thinking to yourself in this time. All logical deduction can be automated with electricity by composing a single kind of element. It would sound less like engineering and more like a category mistake, a pipe dream. Now imagine leaning over to your coworker that's manually moving patch cables. This room will fit in a pocket. The cords will become code. The boards will become microscopic switches. We will treat instructions as data, so the machine rewrites its orders while it runs. Logic will no longer be wired by hand. It will be compiled. A single kind of gate, repeated and arranged, will suffice. The operator points at the patch panel. Where do all these go? Into a layer we'll call software, you say, and the rest into a material we'll call a chip. Billions of tiny switches, doing what these racks are doing now, quietly, cheaply, and fast. Once universality and the stored program idea arrived, practice changed faster than prediction. The same move is available to labs if we agree on primitives and abstractions. A second time capsule, your bench now. It is 2025. The room hums with incubators and shakers. Each instrument is tethered to its own PC. 5 vendor geese, 4 drivers, 3 licensed dongles. To change your protocol, you export to CSV, edit in Excel, re-import, and hope columns align. A camera might watch a plate, but software won't branch on what it sees. The robot finishes. You learn about failure afterward. To say if OD less than 0.3, then feed, else sample means. Rewriting scripts on 3 devices and copying settings by hand. It's easy to imagine this is permanent. Just as ENIAC plugboards once felt. Maximize image. Edit image. Delete image. The breakthrough was the stored program computer. Early computers required rewiring to change behavior. The stored program architecture meant instructions could be treated as data in memory. A computer could modify its behavior by loading new programs. No physical reconfiguration needed. Machines gained the ability to branch, loop, and adapt via software. With basic conditional logic in memory, fixed hardware could handle wide ranges of tasks by swapping code. Hardware became general purpose because instructions were abstracted from machinery. These concepts, universal primitives and adaptable programs, turned calculating machines into general purpose problem solvers. The laboratory equivalent would be finding a universal experimental primitive and abstracting protocols from specific hardware. We need our own NAND gate, a basic experimental step that composes and repeats to build any procedure. And we need lab assembly language, a common instruction set so protocols run on any compliant. Automation hardware, the way software runs on any computer with the right operating system. Lab workflows should branch based on sensor readings and adapt on the fly, rather than being rigid, preset sequences tied to specific machines. Maximize image, edit image, delete image, how standards lift everything. Let me take a brief detour here because there's an important parallel worth exploring. Even computation required humans to reach consensus on basic standards, like UTF-8 or ASCII, that define what digital bits represent. Before ASCII emerged in the 1960s, different manufacturers used incompatible character encodings, making data exchange nearly impossible. A file created on an IBM machine couldn't be read on a DEC system because they disagreed on what bit patterns meant A versus B. ASCII solved this by establishing universal mapping. 0, 1 million and 1 always means A, regardless of machine. UTF-8 later extended this principle globally. These standards aren't part of computing's core technical ingredients, but they're the necessary foundation that makes those ingredients interoperable. History demonstrates the remarkable power of simple human agreements. Whenever entire fields align around machine-readable standards for inputs and outputs, costs drop and progress surges across the board. In manufacturing, the adoption of a compact programming language called G-code, with commands like G01 for a linear, move or M03 to start the spindle, meant that any CNC machine tool could execute instructions from any CAM software. Once G-code became universal, software and hardware could evolve independently yet still work together. Design software could output the same G-code for different brands of machines, and machines could execute code from any software. The standardization led to an ecosystem of tools that all spoke the same language, driving down the cost of precision manufacturing and enabling automation to flourish. History demonstrates the remarkable power of simple human agreements. Whenever entire fields align around machine-readable standards for inputs and outputs, we see costs drop and progress surge across the board. In 3D printing, a simple file format known as STL, essentially a triangulated mesh of a 3D object, became the de facto standard interface between digital designs and printers. One common file type unlocked an entire industry. A designer could create a model in CAD, export an STL, and that file would work with virtually any 3D printer or slicing software. The result was an explosion of innovation and competition in printers and related software, and a drastic reduction in the friction and cost of turning an idea into a physical object. In biology, we've seen the benefit of standardizing data outputs. Flow cytometers, for example, output their data in the FCS file format. Genome sequencers produce read files in FASTA, FASTQ format. Protein structures are shared via PDB or MMCI files. Because these output formats are universal and well-defined, analysis software can be written to handle data from any instrument. A biologist can take a sequencing file from one company's machine and analyze it with a variety of tools or combine it with data from another platform without needing to custom convert file types. The result is a plug-and-play ecosystem where tools snap together, and researchers can focus on insights rather than file wrangling. The pattern is clear. Unify either input or output, and the tide lifts all boats. For artificial discovery, the missing piece seems obvious. We need G-code for wet labs on the input side to complement biology's strong output standards, a simple, agreed-upon way to specify experiments so any automated lab system can execute them. Once labs share a common language for what to do, we could see the same. Cost collapse and innovation boom that G-code enabled in manufacturing. Current solution principles. So here's where lab automation comes in. To be honest, after planning, attending, and hosting 3 years of lab automators, events, I must admit, I keep having this conversation over and over again. We all talk about how we will get to the new age of discovery, artificial discovery, or why we never will. Not going to sugarcoat it, it's frustrating at times. We're living through AI making intelligence cheap and abundant, just like computing went from room-sized calculators to chips in our pockets. We've seen how simple standards like G-code and ASCII ETF 8 can transform entire industries by letting different tools speak the same language. And now we have this field, lab automation, that could be the first to really pull off artificial discovery at scale, and we just can't seem to take it over the finish line. Maximize image, edit image, delete image. This realization keeps surfacing in conversations. We're perfectly positioned to close that loop between thinking and testing, between AI-generated hypotheses and real-world validation. The question isn't whether it's possible, it's what needs to happen to make it inevitable. Most people I talk to think it comes down to a few key challenges. Totally. Except my confirmation bias just recalls the conversations I liked as well. Abstract hardware complexity. Biotech's assembly language. Write protocols in a device-agnostic instruction set. In my ideal setup, vendor differences become invisible. I can compile an experiment once and run it on any compatible hardware. Embed feedback. Biotech's RLHF. Instruments shouldn't just follow a static script. They should sense and respond in real time. I build real-time feedback loops into the process. My shorthand for this is real-time feedback-driven hardware logic. If a signal spikes or a culture isn't growing as expected, the system can detect. It and pivot mid-experiment, just as RLHF uses feedback to refine AI outputs. Define the atomic experimental primitive, biotech's NAND. Identify a general. Repeatable experimental step, such as perturb, measure, decide, repeat. This is the basic loop that can be standardized and scaled. Once we define this universal experimental atom, I can chain thousands of these cycles together into a larger discovery program, confident that each step is compatible and modular. Scale complexity sublinearly as the scope of a project grows, more experiments, more parameters, more robots. The complexity of managing it should grow only linearly or less. This means designing modular protocols and reusable components so that running 1,000 experiments doesn't feel like writing 1,000 separate programs. In practice, 1,000 experiments might be just loops of the same few protocol modules with different inputs. Everyone does agree the pieces are almost all there. We have robots that can pipette and move samples. We have sensors that can measure in real time. We have AI that can generate hypotheses faster than we know what to do with. But we're missing something crucial. We are missing what I believe to be humanity's last organic discovery. In practice, implementing these principles means building something like a lab operating system for experimentation. The OS would handle low-level chores, instrument drivers, sensor readings, error handling, data, logging, so that I can write high-level discovery programs rather than bespoke machine code. It's about having the loops and primitives built in so a scientist can focus on asking questions and defining goals while the system figures out the execution. This is not a new idea at all. We've been at this for a while. The lab OS is everyone's baby, but collectively we do have to ask, why don't we see it? Where is even one example of it at this point? Why attempts fail now? We're still writing in assembly language. Experimental protocols live in prose buried in method sections, or trapped in vendor-specific formats that can't talk to each other. Of course, this vision is easier said than done. Understanding why previous attempts at automating discovery haven't cracked the code keeps us grounded in reality, but unfortunately equally fuels the haters. I think the failure modes follow a predictable pattern. They're essentially the same problems computing faced. We're still manually moving cables, ENIAC logic. Experimental protocols live in prose buried in methods sections, or trapped in vendor-specific formats that can't talk to each other. Imagine if every computer program had to be rewritten from scratch for each brand of processor. That's where lab automation sits today. Without a shared experimental language, our equivalent of high-level programming languages, everything stays bespoke and labor-intensive. In biotechnology, we talk a lot about the space of protein sequences and just how incredibly large it is. You know what's infinitely larger? The space of scripts to transfer a volume of liquid from one plate to another. If you need a new static program for every value of volume in the continuum of volume values, sequence, space is effectively zero. Our hardware stack is stuck in the past. I'm sorry, but this has to be said. Windows PCs attached to every single device are holding us back. We should be able to control lab instruments from our phones, not wrestling with device-specific software that hasn't been updated since 1997. You can find devices that require Windows XP to operate. Microsoft is not even okay with this. Meanwhile, communication protocols remain fragmented and proprietary, creating the same incompatibility chaos that computing solved decades ago. See addendum for more charged, heated opinions on this. We're still thinking in batches, not loops. The traditional mindset in research is to run batches of experiments, collect data, stop, analyze, and then maybe plan a new batch. We're literally taught this in grade school. It is the almighty scientific method. Labs rarely operate as continuous learning systems. They operate in campaigns. This one-and-done rhythm means we're not leveraging each experiment to inform the next in real time. The next experiment is informed by our perception, true or false, that our instincts and brains know the next best thing experiment. Now look, in one-and-done campaign mode, this is sometimes true. It has gotten us here after all. The game we play does, in fact, select the brain as the final arbiter for the next experiment. It's a habit and culture that dies hard. People trust what worked last time and don't easily embrace constantly updating protocols. We lack our scaling laws. Unlike computing power or DNA sequencing, most experimental domains haven demonstrated clear invest X more, get Y more results relationships. Without predictable scaling curves, funders stay cautious about massive experiment pipelines. Sequencing proves the exception. Once the field established reliable scaling laws, investment exploded and costs collapsed. How far did that boom take us, though? We certainly don't live in the age of artificial discovery today, so a more generalized, concrete example is required, in my opinion. Each of these shortcomings maps to one of the principles I outlined above. The lack of standards is exactly why we need to go bullish on an abstract experimental language. I would wager there are right now several of these experimental languages mulling around behind closed doors. However, we're really never going to see the gains unless humanity starts to agree on something. Device-specific brittleness is why feedback and adaptive logic are critical. The one-off batch mindset is what a continuous loop and perhaps a culture shift aims to change. And the uncertainty about scaling is what drives a curiosity for a reliable discovery, primitive and throughput curve. Maximize image. Edit image. Delete image. Beyond biotech, planetary scope. The common thread across all these examples is that adaptive experiments outperform static plans. Whenever we can replace a rigid, predefined sequence with a smart loop that learns from each step, we get more insight for the same or less effort. The vision of artificial discovery isn't limited to biotech labs or chemistry sets. It has a much broader scope. The same pattern of adaptive, feedback-driven experimentation is starting to show its value in many fields. In materials science, researchers use sequential learning algorithms to guide experiments searching for new compounds. Instead of exhaustively testing every combination, systems intelligently choose the next experiment based on previous results. Early projects report 10x to 25x faster discovery of optimal materials using this closed loop approach, a strong hint that a scaling law might exist where smart adaptive trials outperform brute force. I'm going to get a bit detailed here, but only because if lab automation is my passion, I must admit the Navier-Stokes equations are my lust. In fluid dynamics, we have an example of an existing standard awaiting the ingredient of discovery feedback. The field rests on something remarkably simple, the Navier-Stokes equations agreed upon nearly two centuries ago, and simply a generalization of Newton's second law. These equations are essentially the ASCII of fluid flow, a universal language that describes how liquids and gases behave. Whether you're studying blood flow in arteries, air rushing over airplane wings, the motion of glaciers, and even how a fluid will flow on Mars or Venus, there's a million-dollar prize to prove mathematically that this set of partial differential equations truly captures all physical fluid motion. But even if someone proves them insufficient, I suspect it would involve some esoteric mathematical object with extremely abstract, self-referential constructions that bear no resemblance to actual physical fluids. As far as we know, this succinct set of equations still explains the motion of any real fluid. Whether nature solves the partial differential equations herself, or a computer approximates them by adding and multiplying millions of numbers. But here's what's exciting. Engineers are building artificial discovery systems on this old standard. Teams designing aerodynamic shapes run iterative loops where algorithms propose wing designs shapes get 3D printed and wind tunnel tested within hours, and results feed back to refine the next design. It's the same print test learn cycle you'd see in biotech labs, but it works because everyone agrees on what the Navier-Stokes equations mean. This is artificial discovery in action. AI-driven hypotheses meeting real-world feedback. Loops, all made possible by a mathematical standard that everyone speaks fluently. The field isn't stuck writing custom equations for each new flow situation. Instead, they are racing ahead to explore design spaces that would take human engineers decades to map. Thanks for humoring me there. Anyway, in chemical engineering, we see self-optimizing reactors and processes. Instead of running chemical processes at fixed conditions, engineers build systems that vary parameters within safe boundaries and use sensors plus algorithms to continually optimize settings. The reactor itself becomes an experimenter, probing different conditions and learning the best recipe rather than being locked into one from the start. Even beyond traditional labs, fields like astronomy, agriculture, and climate science adopt active learning and adaptive experiment designs. Telescopes adjust observation strategy based on early findings. Crop experiments drop poor performers early. To focus on promising variants, climate modelers use adaptive simulations to zero in on sensitive parameters. The common thread is that adaptive experiments outperform static plans. Whenever we replace rigid predefined sequences with smart loops that learn from each step, we get more insight for the same or less effort. This suggests artificial discovery has planetary scope. It's not just a trick for one field, but a general upgrade to the scientific method itself, applicable anywhere we can close the loop. Maximize image, edit image, delete image. Limits of the computing analogy. As inspiring as the computing analogy is, the physical world imposes constraints that pure software doesn't. A neuron might be slow compared to a transistor, but wet labs are really slow compared to CPUs. A computer program can loop billions of times per second. A biological experiment might take hours or days for a single iteration. We can't change the fundamental pace of chemistry or biology, but we can compensate by running many experiments in parallel and making each experiment as information-rich as possible. In practice, that means high-throughput setups, dozens or hundreds of experiments at once, and instruments that gather multiple readouts from each run. If each experiment is slow, make sure to get a lot ideally mathematically optimal out of each and run many simultaneously. Another hard reality, there are no free reruns in the physical world. If a machine learning model gives an odd result, you can just run it again instantly. You already spent the money to train the model and find a billion numbers arranged in matrices. Matrix multiplication is well optimized these days, so just run it again. If an experiment yields a weird outcome, running it again costs fresh reagents, time, and effort. Every single attempt burns real resources. To deal with this constraint, approaches bias towards strategies like Bayesian optimization and active learning, which extract maximum insight from minimum runs. Every experiment gets carefully chosen to shrink uncertainty or explore crucial parts of the space, rather than mindlessly repeating trials. Experiments also get designed to multiplex whenever possible, measuring multiple variables or testing multiple conditions in one go. That way, each physical run yields more data points, reducing the need for separate follow-up runs. Maximize image, edit image, delete image. A quick aside, we're sitting on a dormant theory that's been waiting for its moment, just like number theory waited thousands of years before cracking cryptography wide open. The reason online banking is secure is because of mathematics involving prime numbers, integer roots of polynomials, and theorems about counting symmetries. The theory of design of experiments, DOE, had its heyday during the industrial age boom of the 1920s, when statisticians like Ronald Fisher figured out how to squeeze maximum information from minimum experiments. Then it mostly faded into manufacturing quality control and agricultural trials. But I suspect DOE is about to have its cryptography moment, becoming the mathematical foundation that makes artificial discovery actually work. While computational evangelists bet on Bayesian optimization and machine learning to guide experiments, I think they were missing something fundamental about physical experimentation itself, something DOE understood from the beginning. The mathematical tools we need might already be sitting on the shelf, waiting to be rediscovered and fully applied. Real experiments. Wobble, biological systems can be capricious. Two cells with the same DNA might behave differently, or tiny changes in lab conditions might throw off results. Building in replicates and statistical controls addresses this. If the system gets a surprising result, it doesn't treat it as gospel. It might automatically repeat that measurement or do a validation run. Part of closing the loop is knowing when data might be lying and having mechanisms to catch false positives or random flukes. Finally, while parallelization is key, it has physical limits. You can't infinitely scale wet lab experiments like spinning up cloud CPUs. There's only so much lab bench space, or so many pipetting robots you can buy. Miniaturization helps. Microfluidic chips and mini bioreactors shrink experiments to smaller volumes, running more in the same space with less reagent. We also pair physical experiments with simulation, run computational models, to narrow down options, then only experiment in the most promising areas. Simulation is an advanced scout that helps focus costly physical troops on hills most likely to hold treasure. Real experiments wobble. Biological systems especially can be capricious. Two cells with the same DNA might behave differently, or a tiny change in lab conditions might throw off results. To overcome these physical limits, there's a consistent set of tactics. Instrument each experiment to collect maximum data. Adapt quickly. When new data comes in, blend simulation with real-world tests and miniaturize experimental setups to fit more trials in less space. These strategies help squeeze maximum progress out of inherently slower, costlier processes, so we can approach the speed and efficiency of our digital dreams even while working in meat space. Maximize image. Edit image. Delete image. Lab not equal to CPU. A recurring claim from computational evangelists is that we should build the lab like a CPU. After all, CPUs revolutionized information processing. So why not apply the same architecture to matter? Because CPUs are designed for a world where the next instruction is always predictable, where programs follow predetermined paths through logic gates. Discovery requires the opposite, a system that can rewrite its own experimental plan based on unexpected results. You'll hear vague analogies of registers to plate hotels, a LUS to liquid handlers, etc. This misses the point. Concepts like OP codes for x86 chips are great. I've been advocating for primitives and atomics this entire essay. We just need to define them before we get to the fun stuff like biological buses, ALUs, and registers. CPUs are universal because they freeze a small set of primitives and push variability into software. Their hardware doesn't reconfigure. The microarchitecture is fixed. Silicon and adaptability lives entirely in the instruction stream. Discovery is the opposite problem. The machine itself, the physical graph of pumps, valves, sensors, temperatures, routes, and readouts, often must change mid-run in response to measurements. In wet labs, the bottleneck isn't sequencing more ops. It's rewiring the experiment as evidence arrives. Put differently, digital universality came from composing billions of identical NANDs. Discovery needs runtime reconfigurability. Perturb, measure, decide. Reconfigure the graph, repeat. If we mimic a CPU too literally, we'll build beautiful but brittle pipelines. High, throughput assembly lines that can only do what yesterday's method anticipated. That yields efficiency without exploration. Yes, we still want universals, our NAND equivalents, and we still want a standard input language, our G-code for wet labs. But the standard must privilege reconfigurability. Branch on sensors by default, upgrade. The topology during execution, keep modules swappable behind vendor-neutral drivers. CPUs won by refusing to rewire the chip. Artificial discovery will win by making rewiring cheap, safe, fast, and automatic. CPUs won by refusing to rewire the chip. Artificial discovery will win by making rewiring cheap, safe, fast, and automatic. Two critical walls. To push this vision of artificial discovery into reality, I propose there are two brick walls we need to break through, climb over, dig under, or dismantle. First, implement adaptive feedback now. We should retrofit feedback loops into today's lab instruments whenever possible. Essentially, give our existing tools a brains over brawn upgrade, adding sensors and control software so experiments can branch or change parameters on the fly. Even with relatively old hardware, this approach already yields wins. An automated cell culture can adjust nutrient flow or temperature the moment a sensor detects the culture, slowing down rather than running the whole batch at preset conditions and discovering failure later. I've seen experiments reach their goals faster with fewer wasted trials once real-time decision-making is in the mix. These early successes prove that closing the loop matters. That even. Without new methods, simply adding adaptivity makes a difference. However, we still see the brittle scope issue. Scoped applications are far from complexity built up from atomic primitives. Even in advanced examples, there's one surefire way to incur a complete rewrite we're done with: small-scale screening. Now we just do large flat-scale cultures. Thanks for all the help. Second, hunt for a breakthrough experimental platform. In parallel with upgrading current labs, explore new methods that could serve as the discovery primitive. For this era, the equivalent of the transformer or silicon chip, but for experimental science. I'm personally drawn to techniques offering massive parallelism, rich data, and broad applicability. Think microdroplet combinatorics systems running thousands of tiny reactions at once, each with its own readouts. Or lab-on-a-chip platforms that integrate synthesis and analysis so tightly they can iterate extremely fast. Another avenue is multimodal assays, platforms that read many different variables, chemical, optical, electrical signals from a single experiment, giving a high-dimensional view of what's happening. The goal is finding an experimental method where 10x more experiments actually gives approximately 10x more discoveries in a reliable way. I want to chart experimental throughput versus discovery yield and see a smooth, predictable climb instead of a plateau. If we can demonstrate a clear scaling law for discovery, double the experiments gives you a clearly measurable jump in breakthroughs. That becomes investor-grade motivation to pour resources into the field, just like the tech industry confidently pours resources into scaling AI models. Maximize image, edit image, delete image. Together, these two prongs create a virtuous cycle. Making existing systems adaptive immediately improves productivity and validates the concept while building the software infrastructure backbone needed to run any new experimental platform. Meanwhile, discovering a powerful new experimental primitive provides the raw capability and throughput that adaptive algorithms can exploit. The real magic happens when these converge. When we have a general purpose, high-throughput experimental platform, and a smart adaptive layer to run it. That's when we'll get the self-reinforcing flywheel we saw with AI. Scalable, hardware, and adaptive software that keep making each other better. If we can demonstrate a clear scaling law for discovery, double the experiments gives you a clearly measurable jump in breakthroughs. That becomes an investor-grade motivation to pour resources into the field, just like the tech industry confidently pours resources into scaling AI models. Why change? We already have the scientific method. the scientific method we memorized in grade school. Ask a question, form a hypothesis, run one experiment, analyze, conclude, was a great teaching tool. But in the age of artificial discovery, it would look like doing math on an abacus. The abacus wasn't wrong. It was just a slow interface for a job we now do faster and more reliably with calculators and code. Likewise, the poster version of science is a step-by-step checklist for beginners, not a playbook for machines, that can run thousands of micro-experiments, watch sensors in real time, and change course mid-run. We're not discarding rigor, we're upgrading the interface. The core virtues, controls, replication, skepticism, stay. What changes is the loop, from batchy one-and-done experiments to adaptive, programs that branch, measure, and rewire as evidence arrives. In this world, the method is less a fixed sequence and more a living system. Hypotheses update continuously. Protocols are written in an executable language with if-then, while, and confirmation happens alongside exploration, not months later. The abacus gave way to algebraic notation and software, the classroom. Method should give way to closed-loop, reconfigurable science. What is it then? I really have no idea. I do think, whatever it is, it will be the last organic discovery moment of human beings. The scientific method we memorized in grade school. Ask a question, form a hypothesis, run one experiment, analyze, conclude, was a great teaching tool. But in the age of artificial discovery, it would look like doing math on an abacus. Hope, the brain. Maximize image. Edit, image. Delete, image. I keep coming back to two facts about discovery at odds with each other. The neuron is slow, so slow that honestly, how does a brain even compete today? A neuron fires at maybe a few hundred hertz. A transistor switches a billion times faster on the order of gigahertz. By raw clock speed, biology is at a hopeless disadvantage. Yet the brain, massive networks of relatively plodding neurons, can do some things no current computer can. Brains triumph through sheer parallelism, adaptivity, and feedback loops honed by evolution. If we design discovery systems with those same features, lots of parallel experiments, lots of feedback, continuous learning, then physics' slower clock becomes a focusing function, not a blocker. We don't need gigahertz labs that brute force through millions of trials mindlessly. We need labs where each slow step is informed by the last, and where many steps happen at once. Slowness isn't a weakness. It forces us to be smart and efficient, to do more with each experiment and to do many experiments concurrently. In effect, we'd be copying nature's strategy. Use brain's adaptive orchestration of many slower parts to beat brute speed. Calling back to NAND gates, the semiconductor industry capitalized on the discovery that any logical statement can be built from NAND gate compositions. That turned manufacturing into a simple mandate. Jam as many NAND gates as possible onto a wafer and let transistors configure wild logic. Even simple statements look incredibly complex when written in pure NAND. Several stages of connections, spaghetti everywhere. They're logically equivalent to elegant logic gates, but take up more space and more ink. If we design discovery systems with those same features, lots of parallel experiments, lots of feedback, continuous learning, then physics' slower clock becomes a focusing function, not a blocker. Now, compare this to the brain, which has finite space and slow signals, but it does have adaptivity. That's a far more profound ability than merely expressing any logical statement as a composition of NAND gates. It's as if a silicon chip could, given a signal, rewire itself and compose more than just NAND, iterating until it found the most elegant, shortest circuit. A dynamic, undulating graph of connections, rather than an enormous, fully connected graph of NAND gates with countless subgraphs that just happen to implement the logic you need. Brains take the opposite bet. Instead of piling up identical parts, they specialize in the fly. A few spikes here, a synapse strengthened there, and the circuit redraws itself. Plasticity acts like a patient editor who knows what to cut. This is why learning a new skill is exhausting the first time, but just another Thursday, the 10th time. Each repetition writes another index card for the mental card catalog, making the next search shorter and smarter. The silicon wafer still uses the same logic gate to add the first time, second time, and millionth time. Maximize image. Edit image. Delete image. There's also the matter of taste, an ugly word in engineering, but crucial in discovery. A brain develops an internal sense of this looks promising long before it can prove anything. Call it curiosity, or prior, or that feeling when a puzzle piece seems like it should fit. We can approximate this with systems that reward themselves for reducing uncertainty, not just clocking wins. And consider time. Digital logic wants everything now, the brain is fine with later, and sometimes sleep on it. That delay isn't laziness. It's background compilation. Offline consolidation reorganizes the warehouse so the forklift knows where to drive in the morning. For artificial systems, this suggests a productive rhythm, bursty bouts of data gathering, followed by quiet periods that distill structure and test alternatives. Finally, energy. Your brain pulls this off on about 20 watts, less than a dim light bulb and dramatically less than a data center. That constraint forced nature to invent tricks, sparsity, reuse, local learning, analogish computation. If we chase those tricks, reflex-focused hardware, dynamic routing, selective, attention, on-the-fly pruning, we might trade gigawatts for good ideas. Discovery, it turns out, is a frugal, energy-minimizing habit of nature, as per usual. Why all this brain discussion? Why harp on the brain? Because, as I said at the start, intelligence is about to be cheap and everywhere. But discovery has never been a bulk commodity. We've had billions of smart people across thousands of years, so many. And yet, we are our few discoveries, not our intelligence. Somehow, all these discoveries came from a shockingly small pile of skulls underground now, or decayed to dust. We can even surprisingly can index these discoveries shelved across a few very large books. That's astounding. It suggests the scarce thing isn't IQ or clock speed, it's the living knack. For pruning and taste, the curiosity that rewires the circuit while it runs. If we can bottle even a fraction of that, machines that learn what to ignore, what to want, and when to rest, then the future won't be about paving the world with NAND gates. It'll be about growing a garden that knows where to weed. Finally, bringing it all back to lab automation. I believe because of everything said so far, it is perfectly aligned to be the first to demonstrate this artificial discovery. The point is not faster pipetting, it is encoding judgment, feedback, and consolidation into the machinery so that pruning happens as a reaction to measurement and at scale. Concretely, standardize inputs that create action. Adopt a portable, device-agnostic protocol language with branching, sensing, and error handling. Publish reference implementations and insist on vendor-neutral drivers so methods outlive hardware. Make feedback first class. Wire sensors to control. Default to protocols with if-then, while uncertainty-reducing measurements, automatic repeats for validation, and scheduled consolidation passes that analyze and rewrite the next day's plan. Prove scaling. Track and publish discovery yield per unit experiment. Run open benchmarks that relate throughput to validated gains. Use Do-Bayesian hybrids and miniaturization to increase information per run. I really, really, really think it's Do that's gonna take the cake, though. Build the OS layer, a scheduler, a data plane, and a driver kit that let protocols be version code and hardware be swappable without rewrites. Invoke a new age of hardware that no longer has to spend resources on designing input communication. Protocols, and can focus on execution, just like CNC and additive manufacturing did. Minimize image. Edit image. Delete image. Fear. New England, once again, miss our shot. We already had a game-winning shot and missed in the 1950s. To 60s, Greater Boston hosted early transistor and semiconductor. Leaders, Transitron, Raytheon, Sylvania, while Route 128 birthed DEC and a dense electronics cluster. By the early 1960s, firms here ranked near the top of U.S. chip sales. A generation later, most had faded. Meanwhile, in California, Shockley's lab seeded Fairchild, whose Fairchildren founded Intel, AMD, National, and others. Stanford's ties to venture capital, a culture of spinouts, and modular. Supply chains turned the valley into the industry's standard setter. Route 128 stayed more vertically integrated and insular, and lost the lead. The worst outcome would be for Kendall Square, the planet's biotech hub, to lose its grip on this age. We can keep making one drug at a time and bring steady incremental value to the region and humanity. Or we can decide to build the platforms that make discovery run faster everywhere. History suggests that the geography that sets the standards ships the operating layer and demonstrates a scaling curve captures the returns. The worst outcome would be for Kendall Square, the planet's biotech hub, to lose its grip on this age. We can keep making one drug at a time and bring steady incremental value to the region and humanity. Or we can decide to build the platforms that make discovery run faster everywhere. The AI boom concentrated extraordinary capital and risk appetite in the Bay Area. That money will look for the next compounding platform. If Massachusetts hesitates, if we accept bespoke tools, vendor lock-in, and one-off programs, Silicon Valley will fund, define, and own artificial discovery the way it did the semiconductor era, something Massachusetts saw had little value, which now drives most of the GDP of the planet. Look ethically, artificial discovery, wherever it starts, deserves pursuit because it will help humanity. But I won't pretend I'm neutral. I live here. I buy my coffee at a 4 across from Amgen and walk through Kendall Square. On the way to work, passing the sleek, fancy buildings new and old of Merck. Moderna, AstraZeneca, Pfizer, Biogen, flagship pioneering, the Johnson, pharmaceutical companies of Johnson & Johnson, Takeda, etc. It would sting to stand for the curtain call on organic discovery and open the playbill, written in New England, produced and directed by the West Coast, while the understudy who covered one rehearsal takes the bow and claims the role permanently. New England is penning the opening acts, biotech's breakthroughs, lab automation, AI grafted onto practice. But if we keep polishing our script one beat, one sentence, one scene at a time, while someone else rushes our rough draft, to opening night, we'll watch from the wings as our creation wins ovations on stages we were too cautious to claim. We should want the third act too. Addendum. Why the heck is our hardware stack stuck in the past? I get the instinct. You have a handful of customers, so you bolt the doors and throw away the spare keys. Retention. The problem is, that's not a market, that's a terrarium. Look back at early computing. We could have had a Tower of Babel, IBM only, DEC only, campus machines that couldn't email the building next door. Instead, we got one of history's most productive boring decisions. Everyone agreed that 0, 1 million, and 1 means a ASCII. Then we stacked more boring agreements on top of that. Sockets, IP, HTTP, and suddenly the world fit in a browser tab. Lab vendors tell me interoperability will turn their beautiful instruments into toasters. No, primitives turn lonely gadgets into kitchens. Kitchens become restaurants. Restaurants become scenes. That's when the magic and the revenue show up. What standards actually do? The short list. Make the pie bigger. More use cases. More budgets. More buyers. Move the fight where it belongs. Accuracy. Throughput. Uptime. Service. Not proprietary file formats. Kill dumb integration work. Fewer bespoke scripts. Faster time to result. Let me swap a robot without rewriting my life. What to build so we can stop arguing. A simple, human-readable, device-agnostic protocol language. Call it the G-code for wet labs with branching, sensing, and error handling. Open version drivers and schemas, plus a conformance test I can run before I buy. Premium on top of standard, better sensors, tighter tolerances, nicer UX, higher reliability. Compete there. Bottom line, be the platform we brag about, not the moat we swear at.